The writer Craig Child says all he thinks about sometimes is the desert. His bio says he's also an adventurer, and that seems about right. He's traveled hundreds, probably thousands of miles in the Southwest on foot. He knows where to find caches of water and ancient ruins. Child says in a new book that it's the presence of thirst and the beating sun and the wind that strips you bare, and on one trip, quite literally, stripped him bare. This was years ago on a trip he took with some friends back before he had kids or a mortgage. He was guiding and living in the desert.
We were out for a month-long backpack. No trails, just using routes across the Canyonlands area. Up and down cracks and touching rock constantly. You find yourself feeling the grains of different kinds of sandstone. You know, changing formations and going, oh, wow, the Navajo sandstone has more quartz in it than the Oregon Rock formation that has more iron. And there's the inquisitive nature of it, of touching the sandstone intentionally to understand it. But then there's also wanting to feel it. Wanting to draw your fingers along old watermarks in a canyon where it's been smoothed. And I would say it's half and half. Half just moving and half admiring, making contact intentionally. Making tactile experiences out of what's around you. And one day I looked at my fingers and my fingerprints were gone. The tips were shiny, kind of glassy. And I think it was just polish from the rock, from constant contact. And it was so exciting because I thought, oh, I'm not me anymore. I'm more this place than I am this person, which is something that is really appealing to me because, you know, the person is messy and complicated. And yeah, the land is complicated and messy too, but it comes down to these very primal elemental layers. And I felt like I was more part of those layers. And then the other people in the group, they were looking at their fingers and seeing the same thing. We were essentially erasing ourselves and replacing ourselves with the desert. I thought that this was a chance to be reborn, to start as this person of this place. And to see my fingerprints come back was this disappointment of, oh yeah, it's just me. And I think we all have that happen. We have some extraordinary moment and we think we are changed for life. And maybe in some ways we are, but in reality, we come back into our bodies. And so I'm left with the memories of that place and being the messy, complex person that I am. And just going, oh, for that moment, I was a canyon. I was sandstone. I would have liked to have stayed that way, but that's not the world I live in. I live in the world of humans and society and fingerprints.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Craig Child says, whatever it is that changes when you spend time in a desert, that it doesn't happen on the first trip. It happens slowly. Once you see the planet falling into pieces over and over, he writes in his new book, you realize the constant workings of nature. He calls the book Virga and Bone, Essays from Dry Places. When you began this book, talk about what you had in mind. And it became this collection of essays. But did you think that it was going to be a collection of essays when you started? Or did you think it might be a longer narrative, a novel, something else? What did you have in mind when you first started?
Well, it did jump around a lot, like any book does before you're really into it. But I think at the core, I wanted to write about the elements of the desert, what makes a desert what it is, and find what stories I have already that fit these different aspects, like bones or eroded rocks or lines of sight and visibility. But going into it, this book in particular, I kind of just opened the door and let it happen. Usually I'm going in with outlines and plans that I, you know, crumple up and throw away 100 times over. But this one, I just said, I'm going into elements. I'm going to write this as cleanly and simply as possible. I mean, you're asking if there's a novel to it or something else. It's a good question, because every other book I do that with, it changes form over and over again. And this book, I just went in and wrote it. This is what came out.
You hold up in Tucson and under pretty Spartan accommodations. You had a couch, you had a fridge, you had a crappy table and chair. So did you want elemental conditions to write this story about the elemental conditions of a desert?
Oh yeah, exactly. I needed a place that just had desert around it and shelter and electricity. I needed it to be as simple as possible, which is, you know, that's what it's like out there. It does come down to those simple features. And, you know, sure, I'd love to have a place where, you know, somebody's bringing me drinks and the fan is blowing and it's all cool and wonderful, but that's not what it's like out there.
You have this moment early on in the book where you write about encountering this rattlesnake.
I saw the snake on the road as I was driving into the place where I was staying, and I was shooing it out of the road, and it wasn't paying much attention to me. And when it finally entered, I think, a creosote bush, its tail was sticking out, and it couldn't have struck me because its head was inside the bush. It was kind of wrapped up in it. And I thought, this is my opportunity to touch its tail, which maybe is not what everybody thinks. But, you know, you look at a situation and you go, well, this is a once in a lifetime right here. I wanted to feel the snake rattling in my hand. I wanted to feel that rattle. And I reached for it. I was probably an inch away from just sliding my hand underneath it. And then I thought, no, you know, what rattlesnake wants this to happen? You know, don't be rude. This is an unkindness.
For a while as you were writing, you said you kept thinking about it.
I kept thinking about that snake as I wrote during the night, its elegant scowl and the sinuous armor of its body, diamond-backed to blend with the shadows. It carries a neurotoxin that won't normally kill, but will give you a run for your money with swollen coal-black appendages and hallucinations. I've always been curious, but I'd rather not find out. The snake is the desert. The fox is the desert, as is the bee that flew in through the open door while I was mincing words and attacked my head, stinging my face, shoulder, and scalp before I hurled it to the floor and squashed it, then staggered back to my keyboard. The country is not easy. Scorpions are here too, and a lush variety of cactus I would not touch, growing all around the house and in the arroyos up in the tapering ridges of the North Tucson Mountains. How could you not admire this sharpness? The buckled horizons and unencumbered views are nourishing. Poisonous things and needle-tipped spines demand attention. A healthy agave with a fresh blade growing straight up, I never hesitate to reach out with a fingertip and touch, reminding myself every time how pointed they really are. We make contact with so many things in so many ways that that we are degrading the world. And so there's the conundrum that comes with our relationship to places, to non-human realms, of how much do you want to encounter this? We need to encounter it. We want to encounter it. And it's a powerful thing. A rattlesnake is, you know, I imagine most of us have relationships in one way or another with rattlesnakes. And I wanted that rattlesnake relationship to be even deeper. And maybe it was because I didn't touch it.
So it seems like there's a lesson there, but I wonder if there's also a theme there in your writing, or at least in your behavior when you're in the desert, which is resisting these temptations in some ways. Like you could touch that pot. You could go into that ruin. There's a loom, right? Or whatever, a magnificent thing that's out there. And it seems like part of the way you think about this is resisting that powerful impulse. Like, yes, it would be great to touch that snake, like encounter that. That would be amazing. And maybe you haven't always resisted that, but that does seem something that's important to you, resisting the easy thing or the thing that's right there in front of you.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that I don't resist so much in the world. The civilized world is so, I mean, it's bright and exciting. Like, I love to go to New York City and just gawk at the lights and the buildings, and wow, you can have anything at any moment. And maybe to counter that, I have this time in the desert where you do take away the immediate gratification. Although, you know, there's so much immediate gratification out there. Every time the wind blows, you're looking up going, oh, wow, thanks. But out there, yeah, you're absolutely right. There is this resistance to having comfort, you know, sleeping on the rocks and walking barefoot and taking away the layers that maybe the rest of your life you kind of pad yourself with. And so at least this is a moment or days or weeks or maybe just minutes where you can't have what you want. You have to have something that's more fundamental.
The book is about elements of the desert. It's organized in, I don't know, it's in these elements. It's organized in maybe these are themes or maybe they're just impressions and images. And you began this almost I guess it's been exactly 2 years ago now. This was March of 2019. You started to write this. You go to Tucson. You hole up there. And I'm trying to think about, Craig, what it was that was happening at the time in the world that might have gotten you thinking about what you wanted to write. I mean, like on the surface, obviously, there's a presidential election underway. There's a very polarizing president. It's a time of wildfires, big questions about climate change, lots of questions going on at the border. Were you thinking about those kinds of things and wanted to say something about that in some way?
Yeah, very much. I felt like there was more at stake than any other time I've written a book. You know, there so much was happening at the border too, and I was you know, I've spent a lot of time down on the border, and so being close to it again, you know, reminded me of what it used to be like. You know, used to be like 20 years ago, not that long ago, when I would be walking along the border and not know if I was 5 miles into Mexico or a mile into the U.S. You know, you just couldn't tell. And so much has changed in that short period of time. And so these things were really on my mind. So I think it changed the tone of the book in some way. It maybe had a darker feel to it, or I had to contend with issues that I, you know, usually can dance around and go, hey, I'm not here to bum you out. We're just having a good time out in the desert. But this time I was going, no, we need to talk about these things. We need to talk about, you know, human trafficking across the border. We need to talk about cruelty and destruction. There's no longer room to slide those off the table.
You write this in the introduction. You write, all I think about sometimes is desert. Why?
There's no better place. I mean, there's no land or life that I know that is brought down to the truth of things, to the kernel, to, you know, everything we wrap our lives up in then gets unraveled, and you get down to what you are and where you are, and just the clarity of being able to see, the pleasure of being able to look out and see 20 miles easily, 80 miles, and know that you can access that on foot, or you can see the distance between here and there. I mean, just yesterday I was walking with a friend along a canyon rim in southeast Utah, and we were talking about, she had lived in Seattle for a while, and she was just saying, I don't get it. All the rain, all the life. And I was saying, you know, yeah, if I could handle that, I would love to live there. But you know, here it is just so pure, and you can, and we were looking out across canyon. We had just crossed from rim to rim, and just saying, oh yeah, you can just point and say, I want to go over there, and you can be there. And yeah, there are cliffs and cracks and ledges, but it's open. It's a very different sense than any other place. The desert for me is the place. Yeah, I dream about it.
Some are born with it, you say. Some come to it later. Sounds like you were born to it.
Yeah, I think so. I did live as a kid on the Front Range, which is high desert-ish, but I'm from Arizona originally and grew up down there in the Sonoran Desert. And maybe I would have come to it if I came from someplace else. I would have realized that this is kind of my makeup. But from the beginning, saguaro cactus is something that's, you know, that's in my early childhood, earliest memories is, you know, and now I still look at the saguaros and I go, oh my gosh, look at those things. That's crazy. We live on a planet with those.
Yeah. You're still amazed by them?
Yeah. Yeah. They're so bizarre, so Dr. Seuss-ish that, you know, where else would you find something like that? But in this desert, yeah, I think I was born to it.
Craig Childs. We're talking about his new book, Virga and Bone, Essays from Dry Places, which is the first selection in the One Book, One Utah statewide book club. The Utah State Library will have an online event with Craig on May 27th. You can go to our website for the details, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Craig Childs is with us today. We're talking about his latest book. It's a collection of essays he calls Virga and Bone. About a year ago or so, he holed up in a small house at the edge of the desert in Tucson to write it. And he says some of the stories were easy to tell, but he struggled with others. And in the book, he says writing should feel like pulling something burning out of yourself. Back now to our conversation. So we don't encounter any names in the book. You sort of leave that out. Again, we're trying to get at the essence of something else. Mm-hmm. But spend a moment, if you would, Craig, and tell us about the pilot. He's a companion of yours.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine who lives in Paonia, Colorado. And we traveled quite a bit before he got his pilot's license. And when he got his license, I said, oh my gosh, we're going to have fun now. because... you know, we can get out and see this stuff from the air and figure things out. He's becoming more experienced year by year, but when we were first flying together, he was just learning, but he's fastidious. He's an ex-urban cop who No, has a sharp eye for detail, so I trust him. He doesn't mess around in the air, and he's got this beautiful old 1947, I think it is, Cessna, clothwing Cessna, tail dragger, just a simple plane, barely fits the two of us. And we go out together and just look at these places and are constantly tipping from side to side, him saying, oh, you look down into this canyon over here. And, you know, it's a plane that's kind of like a lawnmower just puttering across the sky. And then we land out on dirt strips and stake the plane down and put on a pack and head off.
The pilot and I fly together whenever we can. A couple years back, we explored not far north of here, bringing backpacks and hopping one rutted old mining strip to the next in the Utah desert. That had been in October, in mostly gentle air, cool days and crisp nights, perfect for flying. August is different. Days are planned around temperature, airborne at first crack of light, the coolest part of the day, and back on the ground by 1, 2 at the latest, before the sky turns into an inferno of upward winds. The plane needs lift, something to fly on. Hot air is thinner, fewer molecules to push against, not a solid hold. An old cloth wing like this, a 1946 vintage, needs good lift to stay airborne and resist the punishing updrafts and downdrafts of a shimmering desert afternoon.
Do you prefer to travel alone? Or do you, like, it made me wonder what kind of a companion you can stand to be with for weeks on end in the desert. There has to be a kind of kindred relationship, obviously. That's going to be unbearable after time. And I'm just wondering if you prefer to just do it alone.
Yeah, that's a good question, because I really do like being alone out there. It's such a different experience. You're on your own. You're on time frame. I think you're safe. Well, for myself, I'm safer alone, because when I'm with somebody else, I tend to push the boundary a little farther than maybe I should, just thinking, oh, well, if I die, my friend knows where I am. But then being out there with somebody, I think they're two halves of a whole for me, because other people reflect on things in ways that I'm not seeing. And the things that they see, the things they encounter that I'm not picking up on, their ideas, there are kind of specific people. I really only go out with for 30 years now, the same general group of people. And sometimes it is, we know each other so well, it is like being alone. I've had times with some of these people that were out for a day, a whole day of no talking, just moving and spotting each other at a distance and catching up and splitting. And there is something beautiful about the dance of two people moving through a landscape and watching each other. You're in the lead, the other person's in the lead, you're trading off. But then alone, I think I spend a lot more time just stopping and hearing. And, you know, it's like putting a seashell to your ear and listening for the hum. That's what I get when I'm alone.
One of the main images in the book is Virga. And it occurred to me, and I have to say, I'm not sure I knew exactly. I had a general sense of what it might be. What is it, first of all? It might be unfamiliar to some.
Yeah. It's rain that doesn't touch ground. Every horizon out here, you see Virga. You see clouds with kind of those filaments that look like spider web strands, and they're coming down toward the ground, but then they taper off and they don't touch. And that's the rain falling, but then evaporating before, you know, the heat is rising off the ground and the rain evaporates. And I think Virga is such a core desert element. When you asked about how this book started, and originally I was thinking about desert gods, and what are the gods of the desert in my eye? And Virga is the head of the gods. It is the one that is everywhere, and it's so elegant, so beautiful, and so full of longing, because, you know, whenever I'm seeing Virga, I'm going, that's really nice. Could we get the rain to land? Could it come all the way down? Because I want to be in the rain. you know, you look out from Salt Lake City and you look west at the end of a summer day and you see those thunderstorms kind of burning out on the horizon, the Virga coming underneath. It is the name of the desert almost.
You wait in heat like this, scanning the horizon for a cloud, sometimes through a haze of wildfire smoke that turns the world orange, when a drop of rain would be a miracle. You stop in the middle of the day and hold up your hand to the sky, the mountains on the horizon electrified. If the air had more water, if it were East Coast on a sharp summer day, the sky would be washed out in white, hard to tell distances until a plane flies through. In dry like this, you can see into the blue lens of space, eye set to infinity. When you hear the word drought in the desert, it means magnification. These dry, rocky places are made of drought, created by absence, the sky holding back on purpose. When a drought is in drought, a knob with very fine settings is being turned, every hundredth of a degree boiling harder. I saw a creek by my house, which I'd always seen running, dry up and not start again for a year, beaver having trundled off to who knows where or died in their dens waiting for moisture from the sky. Deserts are mummifiers, bone makers. Some years the rain won't come, clouds promising and promising, but did you say the right prayers? Did you pray to the right God? Global measurement of desert precipitation had to be recalculated recently when it was discovered that satellite signals were bouncing off of Virga and not actual rain. 50% of estimated rainfall never reached the ground.
Well, what I think is so interesting about it is that it's not like it hasn't completed its course, but it doesn't get here. Like, it doesn't get to the ground, right? And you write that your word for water sounds like want or desire. Is that what you're getting at? That it's so close, but it doesn't quite quench us, I guess.
Yeah, it's complete in its cycle because it's just, going back into the atmosphere. But we're at this other end begging for it. That's why, you know, when it rains, I don't know if you do this, but I don't curse the rain ever. Even though I feel like it, I go, oh man, I had a lot of plans. And it's raining.
No, when you live in the desert, or when you live in the second driest state in the Union, like we do in Utah, you never curse rain if you're from here.
Yeah, it's not a thing that you do. Even the rhyme "rain, rain, go away," it ends with "come back some other day."
Yeah,
but we don't want to risk that.
Right.
We want it to land, and that's what I think. That's what is so powerful about Virga, is that we have this yearning. I mean, how many times has it been just a hot, dry season and you see the clouds starting to form finally? And I don't know how you do it, if you're praying or if you're just begging or you're thinking somewhere deep in your mind, please just come over here and let loose. There's a lot of tension between us and the sky and the clouds. I think that's a key aspect of being in the desert.
I think a lot of us are thinking about that, those of us certainly in the Intermountain West, because of course now they say we're in this terrible level of drought in Utah in particular and other places. And I wondered, as you are traveling in the desert, which is always dry anyway, are you seeing something different that may indicate drought? Because you write in the book that you think of drought in the sense of magnification. So what are you seeing out there that might tell you about drought?
I'm seeing more dust in the wind. And in particular, where I live in Southwest Colorado, I'm looking into Utah out the kitchen window. So I'm right next to you. And this time of year, the wind starts picking up. And in the last handful of years, especially that wind has brought a lot more red sand, and I can see it from Colorado because it's blowing out of Utah and into the San Juan Mountains behind me, and it's carrying all this red sand, which is then laying onto the snow, which melts the snow earlier, which decreases the natural reservoir of the mountains. Essentially, desert is moving up out of Utah into Colorado, up into the mountains. It's a thing that spreads. Deserts, they move. They're organic. They don't have set boundaries. And so what I'm seeing, longer fire seasons, later frost, this is all to me a sign of the desert expanding and drying things out. It's increasing. It's the concept of desertification, that places under the right conditions will all become desert. Any kind of landscape has the capacity of being desert. So, you know, there is this kind of love-hate relationship with boy, I love desert. And could we just keep it not any larger than it is now? Can it not spread and take over the land around it? And even within the desert, you know, there are places that are dry, but they're getting drier. The dust is mobilizing. The sand is moving.
There's a section in the book called Springs. And you and I have actually talked about this before, that you've thought of yourself as a water hunter. You've written a book about hunting water, basically. But in this book, it's really interesting because you have this section where you are writing about trying to understand where the water is in Death Valley. Because you mentioned how your first time in Death Valley, when you were there, felt like you were starting over. Talk a little bit about that. It must have been disorienting in some ways.
Yeah. Figuring out where water is in a place is it's always a challenge because you've got to figure out the rock formations and how it sits and where it comes out. And being in Death Valley, looking around, going, okay, how does this place work? And it's so big. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any other part of the desert I've seen that is just so vertically massive, and it's all the way to the top. It's desert top to bottom. And then going into the canyons, and it's disorienting. And I like the feeling of disorientation. I like going into a place and going, wow, I don't know where I am. How will I figure this out? And how rocky and hard those canyons are, and nothing like the Colorado Plateau canyons in Utah, the canyonlands where it's, you know, you have the smooth sandstone and water collects in those water pockets on the surface. In Death Valley, it is just this hard, rough rock that scrapes at you. That, you know, we were talking about losing your fingerprints. I think Utah does it nicely over a few weeks. You're just polished, but down there, it just tears your body apart. And so you're reorienting yourself. You're saying, okay, I've got to walk differently here because you can't trip and fall. You know, out here you'll just fall and roll around in the sand, but down there you fall and it's like a cheese grater. And then how does the water work? How is the tipping of the mountains and the bedding plains? How does that feed groundwater down into these canyons? And so you start from scratch. You have to go, okay, it's dry, but there is going to be water, and I'm going to find it.
You say in the book, water does something to you. Like what?
Keeps us alive. And it's, you know, sometimes I think that another planet that doesn't have running water, if you came from that planet and saw ours, you would just go, oh my gosh, you live with this stuff? You drink it? This is, you know, it's like liquid mercury, except it doesn't kill you. And it's so necessary to everything that we do. It just threads through all of our lives, our physical lives, our life of rivers and lakes, and where does the water come from that you drink, and what drainage do you live in? What is the creek, the stream, the river? I think that water names everything, and especially in the desert, it stands out so much that you have to have this relationship with it. And so I think what it does to you is both give you the map of your place, but it gives you this also this more maybe spiritual aspect, or this this connection with an element that maybe you wouldn't have in a wetter place, a place where water is abundant, that here it stands out so sharply that you have to drink it. You have to put it in your mouth because it might not come again.
I will be a doddering old man looking for water, pausing in someone's backyard in Bermuda shorts and loafers, on my hands and knees to drink out of the sprinkler as my kids or orderlies run over to stop me. I'll be the grump in the window, waiting for rain. The last thing my brain ever thinks might be water, the taste of it, too much of it, and too little. On my headstone, inscribe the sign of a spring. The place you inhabit gets into you. The minerals you eat and breathe, the way the sky is shaped in your eye. I prefer the dry places, strong horizons, sometimes cloud-streaked with verga, sometimes sheeted with rain, usually empty. The ground, most of the time, open-mouthed and thirsty, not a drop for most of the months of the year. I found a spring coming out near an ancestral site in Arizona, a place where water flowed through rock and a nest of roots. It was not far from an ancient cliff dwelling, just off an interstate. I peeked into the roots and clear flowing water coming out at gallons per minute and saw a paho, a painted prayer stick, likely Hopi, a marker, an offering, a feather or two hanging from it. This was a spring people had known for a long time. Probably by clan, a map of culture, a map of water. It is an offering you would not touch. The water, though, put that to your lips. It might not be good advice, but in the desert, you should almost drink water everywhere. I cupped my hand in that spring and drank, and it tasted like a cave.
The section in the book about exposure, you say you can't do anything out here, that is in the desert, without someone seeing. And there's a great story. It's kind of a strange story about you sort of on the edge of Burning Man. Talk about this trip.
Yeah, that was a trip across the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. Yeah. And there were maybe six of us who were crossing to Burning Man, taking about a week setting up water caches. And when we got within 5 miles, we had tickets to get into Burning Man so we could legally go in there. But my plan was to come in from the side that people don't come in on. We were coming out of the desert on the north, of course.
And people must have wondered what, like, you're aliens, like, where are you coming from? Because that's impossible or seems incredibly difficult, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you're out on a playa. You know, it's much like the Western Desert in Utah. It's you can see forever. You can see the curve of the earth, and yeah. Which means you're the only thing out there, and they're watching you. We approached the Black Rock city of Burning Man, and they were sending their police team out to intercept us, and they would intercept us and say, you guys have to go around, and we would open the maps and we would say, actually, where your boundary is, and we can keep walking a little farther. And when they finally sent out the head of security, he said, yeah, we've been watching you for days. We've had you on radar. We've seen you from airplanes. You've been walking back and forth. We've been wondering what was up with you guys. We love what you're doing, but we've been watching you. And yeah. And yeah, it's, you're so visible from, because we'd see their law enforcement trucks from probably 2 or 3 miles away as they'd be, you know, just setting up a rooster tail driving out to us. You can't hide. You're always being seen no matter where you are out here.
There's a section called Bone in the book. You mention how you, I don't know if you do this all the time, but I've seen these images. It's on the cover. I think this is you, right? You sketch the bones and the things you find.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do a lot of sketching. The cover is actually Claire Taylor, who does a lot of the art for Torrey House Press. But I do a lot of sketching because it's easy. There are these dry, exposed objects. You know, I can't draw your face, but I can draw a bone on the ground.
Well, because you say in the end, only bone remains, right? That's elemental.
Yeah, it comes down to the simplest forms. Everything gets worn away, and you're left with, you know, the blueprint, the fundamental lines. And that's why I draw those, is because they aren't embellished. They don't have a lot hanging off of them. They are just this core. And the desert I see as a bone in itself. You know, it's the geology that's worn down to its most fundamental shapes. And I think the same thing happens to you when you're out there. You lose your fingerprints. You lose your name. You become this bone, this core thing that's out there that I think reflects the deepest nature of what you are, of what the place is. Mm.
Tell me about the shell you found in the bear's ears.
It was an Olivella shell, which is kind of, it's not like the classic seashell. It's more of a scroll, maybe a little cylinder of a shell. And it comes from the Sea of Cortez, so Baja, mainland Mexico. And I found it at a site in southeast Utah, which, you know, you see shells now and then underneath a boulder or you know, washing down a dry wash. And you know that, oh, this isn't from here. This isn't a local snail shell. This came, you know, 800 miles, 1,000 miles, and there's no geologic process to bring this, and it's not fossilized. So this is a mark of human trade and human movement.
Over the years, I began noticing more shells on the ground as I traveled in the south, closer to the sea, finding bright flecks, lone shells grayed by fire, one scratched around the edge to make a pattern. In a southern Arizona cave, little beads, tiny Olivellas, same genus but different Sea of Cortez species, are in the dirt, as if a slim necklace had broken and they went everywhere. You push them around your palm with a finger, feeling whorls polished by whoever wore these last. Rolled beads of dough, little white pins, you set them back on the ground where they came from, and swish dust across them because the story is not about themselves, but about the cave and where it lies on the land, a place to stop and keep water, a place to sleep out of the wind and drop a small piece of jewelry. Shell trade was big before Columbus and the seething, unthinkable centuries he kicked off. Before that, shells were ornamentation and industry. Archaeological sites turn up workrooms, entire blocks of pueblos or great houses given to shell craft work before the Spanish caught wind of this side of the world. These shells flowed with turquoise heading south and live tropical macaws coming north, a heartbeat rhythm of movement and commerce that thrummed from one desert river to the next.
This lends this human ancestry to a place that can easily look like it's just landscape, that it's just rock and wind and sky, but actually it's a place embedded with these much older memories. And you see that when you find a pot shirt or an arrowhead, but in particular a shell, because you can say, oh, I know where that came from. That came from a long way.
We were talking earlier, you were mentioning the gods in the desert. And you write in the book about this idea of rain and a myth about rain and the god, this rain god who, as you say, leaves this place dry on purpose. This god reveals the world for what it is. Say something about that, if you would, because I know a lot of us are, as I said, thinking about, as we're heading into summer, worried about drought, worried about rain. What's this rain god offer for this idea?
I think this rain god, left this place dry on purpose because it reveals something that can't be revealed in places that have underbrush and forests and rich duff. This comes down to the bare earth or the bare whatever it is that's exposed that wouldn't be seen if it was rotting and covered with moss and ferns. I think this place is made of drought. You know, yeah, we need to be talking about drought because it is happening, but we also need to realize that the place is drought. Yeah, we worry about water. You always are thinking about water here, and that is the nature of being here. You know, the years that we get heavy snows and the mountains are covered into June, those are rare, and I wish they would come again and again, but at the same time, I have to remind myself that's not what this place is about. You know, those are rare moments of abundance. What this place is about is always marginal precipitation right at that edge where you always have to be careful. Even on the years where there's good snowpack and we've gotten a lot of rain, you have it in your mind that I can't use too much of this.
Rain I welcome, but I like the dry too. It is a desert after all, a devotion to sun-brittle wood and waterholes crisp as parchment. You don't want too much rain. There are old stories about that from desert people, warning against what you pray for. Tlaloc, an ancient American water god, leaves this place dry on purpose. His imagery appears on rock art across the Southwest, a goggle-eyed figure whose visits are rare and celebrated. He oversees storms and rain. Where he holds back, he reveals the world for what it is. There is no greater worshiper of water than thirst. To be in the desert is to see under the vellum. Beneath are struts, strands, lines, and cracks. What holds it all together and takes it all apart?
There's something you said early in the book that I think really speaks to your connection to the desert. You write that you once traveled to Tibet for a month. And that if I'm getting this right, on your way there, on your way to this exotic place, that you weren't necessarily just thinking about Tibet. You were thinking about Utah. What do you mean?
Yes, I was thinking about Utah. It's because I was on my way for an assignment to run a river in Tibet, and it was about a month-long trip. And as I was flying over, you know, I was thinking, okay, I've never been to Asia. I know nothing about these mountain ranges. There's a lot to learn. I'm very excited. But man, a month in Utah, oh, that's wow. There nothing would compare because I know how to move there. I know how to find places. And granted, there's not the wild cultural experience of being in another country, but it's constant surprise and it's this guarantee. You know that a month in Utah is going to be astonishing. You are going to see things that nowhere else in the world has. But because I know how to get there, because I know kind of the lay of it, and I know how to walk for days or weeks and find water, the place is open to me in a way that an exotic place isn't. And I will always fall back on the familiar of this landscape because I know how to get to the unfamiliar inside of it. Where if I'm in another country, I'm never going to know. I'm just catching the surface. But here at home, I can get underneath the surface and I can move down there in the underworld of canyons and shadows and mesas and it's so exhilarating. You know, even flying out to Tibet, I was thinking, you know, if I had my choice right now, I'd go back home because I could do things in a month that you wouldn't believe.
Craig Child, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Doug. It's really good to talk with you again.
That's Craig Childs. His new book is Virga and Bone, Essays from Dry Places. And it's the first selection in the One Book, One Utah statewide book club. The Utah State Library will be having an online event with Craig on May 27th. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.